But tonight I'm going to... Kay had a request. So tonight's Kay's request. She asked if I would kind of debrief a little bit about the experience that we had in Long Beach at the initiation that wasn't. So I will. And but this will be a real change of gears from pretty much anything that I've done before or any way that I've talked in the past. And part of the reason for that is there's just no other way to talk about our take on the experience. So we met a lot of old friends when we were down there, which was really quite wonderful. Sandra, who is a fellow student of our teacher, Denma Lhotra Rinpoche, Bob Thurman, who is one of Kay's patrons, commissioned a couple of tonkas from her, but I've known Bob since before he got tenure at Amherst College in the late 70s, so we go back a long ways. And Tenzin Dorje, with whom I worked on a couple of translations when we were in Dharamsala. And Tenzin has now gone from being a monk to a professor of intercultural communications at Cal State Fullerton, because for some inexplicable reason he went to UC Santa Barbara and eventually got a PhD. So it was wonderful to see all those people. Unfortunately, what was not wonderful was the Dalai Lama didn't show up. And it was a pretty interesting weekend. It started out with a royal wedding, and Kay woke me up in the middle of the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. And that was interesting because we thought about it in very archetypal terms. As the, I think it's called the Hieros Gamos, a wedding of principles. And very interesting because if you think about it, really, when you looked at that couple, it was the future. You can see the future. It was interesting for other reasons, too, that I won't go into, but it just seemed cosmically significant in many ways. The day of the initiation that didn't happen, the most wanted person in the world was assassinated by U.S. troops who flew into a compound in helicopters. And I was reflecting on the fact that the future King of England is by trade a helicopter pilot. I mean, after the wedding, he went back to his base and he flies helicopters, search and rescue, which is very interesting. So, you know, that gets into issues of patterns and harmonies or non-harmonies. Monday that we were in transit, a number of things happened, including a bomb dropped at EOU in a certain respect. And the provost met with 14 people individually and fired them, faculty members, 14 faculty members in a row, and fired them. That's never happened before, to my knowledge. Something else happened on Monday, and I can't remember what it is.
But there was a tornado in Alabama.
Oh, tornadoes in Alabama.
Yeah, it just seemed like one of those patterns.
Yeah, it was one of those weekends where a lot of stuff happened. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, so the Dalai Lama presumably got a sore throat and couldn't come. We were sicker than all get out. Kay was having noises in her head, and then she couldn't walk, and all kinds of horrible things were happening. And she couldn't find any of the medications that she needed to usually control those things, even though they were in her suitcase, which we didn't discover till we got home. And David was running all over Long Beach looking for all of these things, which could not be found because health food type or naturopathic whatevers don't survive in Long Beach. We had no idea where we were, and everything was closed or 20 miles away. And then Saturday night, I turned my head in the middle of the night in bed for no unusual reason, and all of a sudden my dizziness came back. and I've been nonstop dizzy for a week. And my first experience of that was in the early 90s when we were on retreat in Dharamsala at the Dalai Lama's monastery, and the very same thing happened. I was laying in bed, woke up, sat up, and all of a sudden the room just went, started spinning around. And I was completely whacked out for weeks. And then it was back again. It's happened off and on since then. So I would have gone to the initiation that wasn't, and I would have sat there spaced out of my brain full of miclazine with the room spinning around for not cosmic reasons, or maybe for cosmic reasons. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And it's kind of, when you look at those sort of things, you have to wonder what the heck is happening. So the afternoon that His Holiness was first supposed to arrive and do his preparations for the Yamantaka initiation, I ran into Tenzin and gave each other a big hug and had a great time catching up and talked about what was going on. And he said, well, you know, when His Holiness was the one who suggested doing the initiation, and this is a very unusual thing to be doing, and he almost never does anything like this in the West. He rarely does it in India. Well, no, he does it more frequently in India, but he's almost never done anything like this outside the Tibetan community. And so that was very unusual, and it was his idea. And he created all these very conservative restrictions for people who wanted to practice, which was to do the guru yoga 6 times a day, and to do the Yamantaka sadhana every day, and to take a retreat, which is 100,000 mantra accumulation retreat, and that usually takes about a month. So he was real serious, and everybody who was attending was supposed to commit to doing that. And Tenzin said he thought maybe 300 people might show up from all over the country. Well, there were over 2,000 registrants, and he said that really concerned him, because he really didn't believe that all those 2,000 people were going to be really serious.
Look at how hard it is just to do green Tara.
Right.
So Tenzin said he thought that the protectors had prevented this from happening, and that was the reason that not only that the Dalai Lama had a sore throat, but that his physicians told him not to travel. He was in Tokyo. And that he listened to them, which he almost never does, apparently. But, as was pointed out by Thubten Jinpa, who did one of the talks, who's His Holiness's main translator, the last time His Holiness got sick in this way on a tour and didn't knock it off, he was sick for months afterwards. So he's taking better care of himself. So you can look at the experience on many different levels, and that's what I thought I was going to talk about. Because he actually wanted me to talk about what the heck are the protectors. And I've always talked about Buddhist practice in a very kind of matter-of-factish kind of ordinariness, like it's all very practical and straightforward. And if you understand the theory behind things, there's nothing really unusual kind of approach to Buddhism. So not tonight. Because Kay asked me not to. So, but I have to start where we've started. And so where I'm going to start is with a question or a quandary, and then I'm going to put it in a certain context. And to loop back momentarily to EOU, one of the things that was a bomb that fell on Monday was that the university extirpated the religious studies program just like that and said, you're not going to offer any more courses and the program's gone effective at the end of this term. Why? Well, they had bad data, and we convinced them pretty quickly they had bad data and that it was a moneymaker, and that you don't kill a moneymaker in a period of time when you're trying to make money for the university. And so within 20 minutes on Thursday, the dean had said, oops, that was a mistake, program's back. But we had to get there. So that was one of the Monday things. which I was reading on my cell phone Monday night as we're driving back from Tri-Cities. What? Oh, my goodness. Okay. Also, my boss has been fired. Well, that's interesting. How you can have an information technology unit without the boss? Well, I don't know. We're working on that. The main theme of the program, the religious studies program, is religious pluralism. And the issue is, when you have multiple religions that all say they have the truth, the capital T truth, and those truths don't agree, and they're all engaged with each other on this little planet, do you have a problem? Yes. You have many problems. How do you deal with that? And so that's the theme of our little program, is looking at all those different religions and asking questions about how do you deal with the fact that Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, and whatever else you've got all think they've got the truth, and their truths are all pretty different. And in some respects you can find alignment, in other respects you can't. And His Holiness has actually talked and written about this with some very interesting thoughts. But I'm not going to refer to him. I'm just going to say that's a problem. There's another problem, and there's another religion out there that doesn't get talked about very often as a religion that needs to find a way to be compatible with the rest of the religions, and that's science. Most people don't tend to think about science as a religion, but if you look at most of the way most unself-conscious scientists practice science, you realize it is a religion. There are heresies, there's a high priest and priestesshood, and there are all kinds of stuff like that. And at its worst, it's called scientism, which is a real religion of science, and at its best, it's just science. Most people are someplace in between and all of that. So figuring out how science fits into the picture is an interesting problem, and it's especially interesting for us because of the way in which we're raised. I mean, we're raised in the modern Western world, and science is the soup in which we're swimming, whether we like it or not. And it's the perspective that we bring to most of what we do, whether we like it or not. And even whether we know it or not, you know. There's nothing wrong with that, but it creates some challenges because it's reductionistic, it's materialistic, and a few things like that in the way it's usually practiced. And it's not real big on appreciating things that are not material and not replicable through scientific experiment. It just says, at best, we can't know about things, and at worst, they don't exist, they're superstition, they're irrelevant. Well, pretty much everything religion cares about falls into that camp. And some people have said, okay, so you've got the world that religion deals with, and you've got the world that science deals with, they're different, they don't overlap, and that's fine. But that doesn't make any sense, because we're human beings, and we're in the middle of all of that stuff. So this has been an issue for me, because the way I was raised was very much in a scientific context, and my parents weren't scientific, but, you know, it's the way the school was, and I was going to be a biologist. It's the way I sort of started out my scene in high school and in college. That's what I was going to do. And then I discovered that I wasn't. That's a whole other story, but anyhow, that was my framework. And so I understood science very well. And the scientific method very well, and the strengths and limitations of science. So whenever I'm thinking about anything Buddhist or religious, it always does tend to come from that perspective, which I don't know, maybe you get a sense of that in the way I talk, and maybe you don't get a sense of that in the way I talk, but it's there. It's there all the time. So there's a problem, because if you look at human beings from the sort of standard scientific materialistic point of view, there's no reason to believe anything is going on after you die, for starters. Okay, and if you look at all the research that's going on with brain science, they're pretty much trying to explain everything based upon the way different parts of the brain function in relationship with each other. And they found some amazing things, because the electroencephalographic technology now, and I think that that's the best way to describe it, is very good at reading the electromagnetic patterns that develop in the brain and localizing them very specifically, so that if you're thinking in certain ways and cognizing in certain ways, whether you're doing mathematical analyses or you're listening to sound or you're imagining music or you're remembering events, they actually can track the different parts of your brain, quote, light up, unquote, in through their technology. And it's quite amazing. And they, you know, being good hardcore materialists, they think it explains everything. And maybe it explains a lot, I don't know. But if that's true and that's all there is to it, then for one thing, you know, nothing that religion has to say about higher values, probably, and certainly nothing religion has to say about life after death or before birth, fits that pattern at all. But it doesn't seem to me that very many scientists have drawn what I would take to be kind of an interesting conclusion, which is that they've pretty much proven that the brain operates on the basis of electrical activity and it generates an electrical field of one kind or another, and that those electrical fields are constantly changing. That's the reason the technology works. So here's an interesting question. Buddhists and, in fact, Hindus and many other people say that consciousness, which is mostly what we would call the essential part of a person, if not a soul, is an energetic phenomenon. So is that what is being generated in this kind of electrical framework, if you will? So let's suppose it is, just for simple sake. Let's say that consciousness is an energetic phenomenon, and that the patterns of electrical activity that we see on the brain are, in fact, consciousness. So, where do we go from there? Well, for one thing, one of the things I've said in the past is the Buddhist view about waking state of consciousness, dreaming state of consciousness, and dreamless sleep is that consciousness is always there. And in dreamless sleep, where we think we're unconscious, we're conscious of nothing, according to Buddhist thought. And that would be held as true by the brainwave studies. It's not like the brain turns off. There's an electrical pattern going on when you're in dreamless sleep. So that if that electrical pattern is consciousness, then it's there. It's just not aware of anything. And in fact, they do say that the sense organs are pretty much shut down and almost in a paralytic condition at that state. So if everything is known through the sense organs, then nothing's known. So that's all consistent. One of the things that's always struck me as interesting, though, is, and they haven't gone, and the scientists don't go here, but one of the things that's always struck me as interesting is, I'm getting there, Kate.
Okay. I'm fascinated.
Okay. So
interesting.
Okay. So one of the things that's always struck me is that one of the things we know about electrical patterns is every electrical pattern or magnetic pattern interacts with every other electrical pattern or magnetic pattern. They're never independent of each other. But the brain scientists never seem to want to talk about this. But it's just the way energy is. It's just the way electrical fields are. I mean, it's not a big deal to go from one place to another. So that means if there are eight of us sitting in this room generating electrical magnetic fields in our brains, then we're all resonating with each other to greater or lesser degree. That's unavoidable. And also, by the way, the people next door down the street and, at some level, the whole planet, right? So now, isn't that interesting? Because one of the things we know about the whole planet is that at any given time, you know, roughly a third of the planet is sound asleep, either dreaming or not. The other two-thirds of the planet are awake, maybe daydreaming, but more or less, you know. And this flows around the Earth on a 24-hour basis, where a third of the human beings around the Earth are going to sleep, and that, like, sleep wave is going around the Earth on a 24-hour basis, like that. So right now, there are a lot of people in China there are more people in China at the moment who are sound asleep than awake, presumably. Or maybe China's not a good example. India's 12 hours off. Well, that doesn't work because it's early morning in India. But you got the concept, okay? Which means the other thing that's going on is at this very moment, there are probably a billion people dreaming. And I wonder what they're dreaming, you know, and how are their electrical fields interacting with my electrical field, which is now awake? So nobody talks about this stuff, but isn't it interesting, don't you think, that now we have this mega electrical field of all these brains that are connected with each other in a certain way? Now, from a Buddhist point of view, the fundamental ignorance that people deal with and confuses them about everything is this idea of self, right? That there are entities which are independent from each other. And the whole theory of emptiness is about deconstructing that so you can see how everything touches and connects with everything. There is a passage, hold on. There is a passage in something the Dalai Lama wrote somewhere, and I could never find it if my life depended on it, in which he says, when you start understanding the emptiness of things, then there's a lot of progress. He said, when you start understanding the emptiness of consciousness, then there is amazing progress. Now, understanding the emptiness of consciousness doesn't mean there's no consciousness. Understanding the emptiness of consciousness means understanding that consciousness is not a solid, if you will, thing. I mean, we think of my awareness is just there, solid, there it is. I mean, even if we take in all kinds of interesting chemicals, at some deep level, we still have that view that I have a solid, continuous type of consciousness, which is me. But from the Buddhist point of view, you have a consciousness which is made up of a flow of moments in which each moment is dependent upon the previous moment and the conditions that surround it, and that all of that stuff generates kind of a consciousness which exists in dependence on the self or sense organs. Because from the Buddhist point of view, consciousness always arises in relationship to an object of consciousness, even if it's nothing. Consciousness always has an object. Whether it's a dream, a thought, a sense experience, or nothing at all, consciousness always arises in relationship to an object. It depends. These things depend on each other. So, you put all that together, and what do you get? Well, as I said, the Dalai Lama says, if you begin to understand the emptiness of consciousness, when you deconstruct your general notions of consciousness, unusual things happen. And in particular, all the ways in which you think about your consciousness as yours, as apart from anything else, change. You see yourself differently, you see it differently, you see its relationship to everything else differently. In fact, it isn't even yours anymore when you start looking at it that way. Because one of the things that you almost instantly become aware of is, if consciousness only arises in relationship to objects, one of the objects that always arises in relationship with is the sense of I. So I am an object of what I call my own consciousness, which means it can't possibly be my consciousness, right? Because it's aware of me. Now, wrap yourself around that one when you're meditating. It gets you pretty interesting territory. So it's not my consciousness. I am its object. So what is it? Well, is it only inside of the space between your ears? Well, electrical fields may be generated in one location, but if multiple electrical fields are generated in multiple locations, they all interact with each other. That means there's just one mega electrical field expressing itself locally, but there's a bigger thing going on. And those things all interact with each other and flow into each other and impede and impact each other. Impede and impact each other. So, it always seemed interesting to me that in the 1960s, even though I'm still on the same target here, the same track, in the 1960s, even though Maoist China had basically no relationship with the outside world, there was a youth revolution in China. There was a youth revolution in Paris. There was a youth revolution in the United States. In the Western world, you could see how all these things connected with each other. But how did it connect with what was going on in Maoist China? That is incomprehensible, except to think of the fact that we're one big mega electrical field mind, and stuff flows around that space and expresses itself through us in a certain way. So this flips causality, or the notion of consciousness as being dependent on the body, around in a very interesting way. Because I've not said that the electrical field is not dependent upon the bodies that are generating it. I've simply said, with 4 million bodies, there's a great big electrical field out there, and if one body falls away, it doesn't have a whole lot of impact on that electrical field. And if that electrical field is what is the consciousness in you expressing itself through you, when your body falls away, nothing changes. See, if you think you are the consciousness in your body and that's the limitation, then it's a problem when you die. But if you come to see that you are the consciousness which is spread out over the whole planet, it's not a problem when you die. And it explains what was going on before you were born. And it explains how it is that what you do in this life leaves a trace in that larger field, which persists over time also, which is the big problem for Buddhists to explain, because they didn't know about magnetic fields exactly. They sort of did, but they didn't know it the way we know it. Okay, so now, who are the protectors? What happened over this weekend? How can you think about what happened over this weekend? When you have a big mega electrical field like this, I swear when I was watching the royal wedding, when Kate got kissed by her prince, you could feel all over the world this kind of like, ha, thing happen. I mean, it didn't just happen in me. I could feel all over the world there were people who looked at that and thought, wow, that's really cool. You know? And I thought, what's it like for those people? You know, they're standing on the balcony. Like, apparently she walked out and looked out there and said something like, oh my, or wow, or whatever. But she got a bigger wow than that, which she may or may not have known of, from my point of view, you know. I mean, I could just really feel this. I mean, I remember the first time in the San Francisco area in the 60s, several radio stations got together at the same time to broadcast some live concert, the Grateful Dead or whatever it was, I don't even know. And everybody sat down all over the Bay Area and toked up and listened to this stereo concert that was happening live through two different radio stations. But you had to get together, right? And you had to bring your stereo to somebody else's place so you could listen to this thing. And then there was a television broadcast also. So if you knew somebody with a television, which was unusual at that particular point in time, you could see it and hear it over two radio stations and one television station. And it was a complete telepathic experience all over the Bay Area. I mean, anybody who's there will tell you about this. It was a very interesting experience. These things happen, but we ignore them. Right? When the stock market's melting down, there is a sense of panic which goes beyond the localized what's happening here to me sense of panic. It is larger. You can feel it. You know, you can feel that level of terror when it's going on. A couple weeks before the tsunami in Japan, Kay dreamed it. She saw it. She saw the photos. She saw things that were later photographed. She didn't know what it was. She didn't know where it was. It wasn't useful in any particular respect. It's just, she saw it. How do you explain these things? What's going on? When you step into this space, you step into the space of uncertainty and mystery. One of the things that governs the way we think about modern science is what's called the uncertainty principle. And basically the way it works is there are certain phenomena that change as soon as you try and measure them. Okay. So light is a wave if you measure it one way and a corpuscle if you measure it another way. It can't be both. Everyone knows that it's either one or the other. Well, if you measure it one way, it's a wave. If you measure it another way, it's a corpuscle. It's because it's a phenomenon that responds to interactivity. It's the only way to explain it. Well, consciousness is like that also. In the Buddhist scriptures, when people say, what is it? It's described as being luminous and knowing. Consciousness is luminous and knowing. That's the classic description in Buddhism of what consciousness is. The Hindus say it's existence, knowledge, bliss. Same thing. as far as I can tell. But anyway, they don't say it's luminous. Buddhists say it's luminous. It's a phenomenon of light, right? So this global consciousness changes in dependence on how you interact with it. That's why it's a big mystery, right? You want it to be Allah? It's Allah, and it's a stern God. You want it to be Buddha mind? It's Buddha mind. It's neutral. You want it to be Shiva? Sure, it's Shiva. It's because that's how you interact with it. Okay? It's a big mystery. It can't be all those things. But it can be all those things. And it's full of stuff which is incomprehensible. And one of the things that's incomprehensible is what the Tibetans call the protectors, which is to say there are forces that exist in the collective consciousness which impact what's going on in the collective consciousness. Carl Jung wrote extensively about it. He said the problem with the modern world is people refer to this stuff as it's just the mind, it's just consciousness. They psychologize it. He said, what a limited view of all of this. But okay, that's our view, so you can have it, that's fine. But he said, but in the collective consciousness, and he really meant it, in the collective consciousness, there are patterns that exist that influence everybody. That's why I call the royal wedding the Hieros Gamos. Because as a lot of people have begun to wonder, is the myth of the future about the royal wedding? We've had matriarchy, we've had patriarchy. Is the future about those two things coming together? We've also had cosmic evil that particular weekend, being extirpated by presumably whatever it was. I don't know. I won't even get into the whole issue about assassinating people and whatnot. That's a sidetrack. I don't want to go there. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff floating around this huge global mind, which is good, bad, or indifferent. Most of it incomprehensible, and a lot of it's stuff that we never think about as even existing, because we don't even think of those connectivity, of those elements of connectivity, as being one whole something full of incomprehensible stuff. Whatever the protectors are, they are forces that exist there which take care of us, which get in our way, whatever you want. They're the forces of panic. They're the forces that create World War II. They're the forces that, you go down the list. And there isn't a lot more to say about them because they're incomprehensible to us, except that we see the pattern of larger forces and powers that are beyond us. So Tenzin Dorje said, well, this Yamantaka Sadhana is a serious business. And for 2,000 people to take this initiation and then not follow through with it is not acceptable. He didn't say this, is not acceptable. He just said, it doesn't feel right. And so it wasn't going to happen. And so the Dalai Lama got a sore throat and didn't come to the United States for the first 2 days of a tour. So the initiation didn't happen. Now, it was just a sore throat. But he doesn't usually listen to his doctor's orders. But he did listen to his doctor's orders. Was it just a sore throat? Why did he get a sore throat? Why was my head spinning? Why couldn't Kay find her medication? Why was it that our old friend Sandra brought her drug-addicted granddaughter up to this experience who got her head turned around even though none of it actually happened? I mean, on and on and on and on. Yes, Kay?
Just the only point that might be interesting here, too, would be the whole thing about protectors protecting the Dharma, the larger idea of the Dharma. Because he did, it's like he said that's their job, is to protect the Dharma and to protect the truth. Do you have anything to say about that?
No.
Except that there were forces like, Padmasambhava, great wizards or great accomplished citizens within the Buddhist tradition who harnessed some of those forces and turned them towards protecting the Dharma. Anyway, this is the mythology that is within Buddhism, and that these protectors protect the people that are practicing it, they protect the teaching itself from degradation. It's like,
I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, yes, there are forces out there that are capable of being realigned. How's that? And, you know, all the religious traditions talk about them. There are angels in the West, and there are protectors in Buddhism, and there's every kind of thing imaginable in Hinduism. And, you know, the locals, they believe in all kinds of spirits that are everything in trees and clouds and Great Spirit. And all that stuff, which we modern enlightened people wrote off through our science as superstition and pre-rational and so on and so forth, from my point of view, needs to be thought about in a totally different way. Because it's unbelievable arrogance for we 20th century modern people to think that everything that was known and believed by everybody that came before us up to 100 or 200 years ago, they were all wrong and we are right. Now, I'm more willing to believe that we're all equally wrong or all equally right than to believe they were wrong and we were right. That just, I mean, we may be able to send people to the moon, at least one generation of us could do it. I don't think we could do it anymore. At one time we could send people to the moon, but that doesn't mean that there's a whole lot of other stuff that they couldn't do that we can't do. And that just does not make any sense to me. I'm going to leave it at there. I'm getting preachy here. Oh, sure, questions, okay. See, I told you this is going to be different than usual.
Yeah. I was thinking of the Middle East, too, what has happened and how it has just blown up. Now there's proximity, so information can pass
right
quickly from one country to another country, but still.
Something's happened.
The force at which this is germinating.
Right. Now, of course, if you were Muslim, you would say, well, this is all Allah's will. It's time for a change, and he's bringing about a change. And that would be, I think, a perfectly reasonable explanation. Because what is Allah but the collectivity? And the collectivity is bringing about a change. That seems pretty apparent. And it seems also reasonable that Osama would go away at this particular point in time because his people, on a more positive note, have said the Islamist view that he espoused may have been a view that was more acceptable to people from the point of view of bringing about change in 2001. But a lot of people in the Muslim world looked around and said, we don't need that. I mean, this is what some of the commentators are saying. We don't need that. We can make this change ourselves, and we are making this change ourselves. And it has nothing to do with the United States. You know, I mean, it's not settled in Syria, that's for sure, and who knows where it's going in Egypt or any of these other places. It's not settled, yeah, it's not settled in Libya, but, you know, change is happening in some way. It's all up for grabs. Yeah. So Osama's time has passed anyway, in every respect.
But it's very interesting to look at it in this different light, because as you say, a Christian could say, oh, God's punishing bad people, or he is doing something in history. See, I told you God would work.
Right.
Of course, when things go wrong, God's teaching you something or whatever.
Right.
But then it narrows, and it keeps one from looking at this as a energy field that is not to be contained by a concept.
Except when a whole bunch of people get together and hold a concept that changes that energy field, if not locally, then broadly.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I mean, if in the Middle Ages, you know, a million crusaders think they're right and the Muslims are wrong, from their point of view, God's on their side and it's true. What's complicated is, from the point of view of the Muslims, they think God is on their side, and that's equally true. And that's what's so hard for us to cope with.
But But aren't you saying that they get stuck and it's about
sure.
them? It gets embedded in the art,
oh,
the
yeah.
nationalism,
yes,
or the
absolutely.
Tribalism.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't get out where that is. There's still an energy there, but I'm stuck.
Okay, well, but it does have limits. I mean, in biblical times, in Old Testament biblical times, if you really look closely at what these tribal groups are talking about, like, you know, Moses and his uh-huh. immediate successors, they're really talking about our God versus your God. There's no place where they say that your God doesn't exist. They say, yeah, your God exists, but our God's going to kick your God's butt.
Our God's bigger than your God.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's like, it's our God. Right, and our God's the, you know, ours is right, and in this particular situation, yours is wrong because we won and you lost. That makes ours right. I mean, that's really what they were talking about. That's how they didn't understand. Yeah, they didn't understand God as like God of like the source of all existence. That was not what they viewed this as. I mean, that did come, but it came much later. It was like our local dude versus your dude, you know. And by the way, our local dude had a wife. It's something that they don't talk about very often, you know. Because back then, all those dudes had wives, right? And some of the dudesses were tougher than the dudes, you know. I mean, so, but it's very hard for us to step beyond the rational and say that two opposed propositions can both be true. That's one of the places where things stick. Because in this point of view, which is sort of like, you know, the quantum physics point of view, to extrapolate from that, it changes in dependence upon how you measure it and think about it. So you can have two mutually opposed points of view and realities that are equally true to the people that hold them. That's not something human beings really like to deal with. I think that that's a real problem for people. I don't have any trouble with it, but I'm nuts. So there's, you know, when you're nuts, it becomes easy. But having said all of that, so why is it when people say, well, you know, we'll all get together and pray, something will happen? Well, yeah. I mean, that, you know, scientific view is not so hot on that. You know, a bunch of people get together in church and pray for something that's going to happen. Does it happen or not? I don't know. But a bunch of people getting together, believing something yeah. together makes something different in that space. And so I firmly believe that one of the reasons that it's a good thing for Buddhists to continue to hold the view of bodhicitta and the altruistic view, you know, somebody's got to sit down and say, let's get it together and take care of each other, because everybody else is running around with a whole lot of other views. So it's important that idea be out there in some sort of coherent framework. I mean, this summer, the Dalai Lama will be in Washington, D.C. doing a big initiation called the Kala Chakra, which most people go to not to practice it, but as a blessing. So he always says that this is good for world peace. Well, imagine, you know, 10,000 people in a park, all focused on the Dalai Lama, who knows how to control his mind, who's holding in his mind the thought, world peace. And all that energy is flowing into his awareness, and he's got plenty of energy himself. And he takes all that energy and he puts it into that little package, and he sends it back out to the world. I mean, that's a good thing. Somebody better be doing that. It's probably the best thing that ever goes on in Washington, D.C., So, does it impact world peace? Well, it's better than nothing, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, it's better than everybody sitting around, I got mine, you go get yours, and who cares, you know. I mean, if we turn the universe into a zero, if we turn life into a zero-sum game, it's pretty gnarly. You know, there's no reason why everything can't be win-win. There may be limited resources on the planet, but the most important resources aren't limited, you know. So getting preachy again.
So
this isn't
talking,
Sunday school.
I actually had just kind of this wild thought about animal consciousness.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even go there.
And was thinking about that when you were talking in kind of that whole other realm or another realm of mm-hmm. consciousness that you may not always... be aware of, or and just, you know, that reverberating out.
Right.
Kind of these whole other sentient beings.
Well, yeah, the Buddhist view is that there's six main realms. The human realm is only one. Then there's the animal realm. Then there's the realm of ghosts. Then the realm of heaven, realm of titans. And I'm sorry, there's also hell. You know, we don't like to talk about that. But in the Buddhist view, these things all exist. And animals and humans are the only material beings. All these other things are non-material. So you want to talk about what's going on in the larger space. But they go one step farther. They say, life on Earth? Well, that's not the only place. But even our scientists have said, hey, guess what? We got that one figured out, too. We've looked around, and we figured it out, and there are X number of planets out there, which they've now discerned in the last few years. They know there are stars all over this galaxy that have planets. And the question is, how many of them are close to what kind of star? So the water-based life, water and carbon-based life are possible. And they've run the statistics based upon the number of such likely planets in this galaxy. This is scientific. This is not David woo-woo. This is scientific. They've run the statistics, and there is no doubt whatsoever that there are other planets like this one, this size, close to suns like ours, with water on them, with this level of heat and gravity, and there will be life there. That was actually reported on PBS Evening News about 4 months ago. I said, okay, you know, our telescopes in outer space that we've sent around the Earth have seen planets on other going around other stars. It's definitive. We've worked it out, and we've looked at one little quadrant of the sky, and we figured out how many are there. So you multiply it times all the quadrants, and we've done the math. They're planets like ours, no question about it. And the corker is, this is only one galaxy, and how many galaxies are there, right? So from the Buddhist point of view, they've been saying this right along. Oh yeah, there's life all over the place, you know. You can get reborn any place, which is convenient since we're making a mess of this planet. You know, so if you really get into it, what does that mean? So what is the relationship between the consciousness energy fields on this planet and the other planets? Right? I mean, how do these things relate to each other? You know, there is something, I think it's called Bell's Theorem, which posits action at a distance, instantaneous influence, instantaneous action at a distance. And there have been experiments about this, too. So there's no particular reason why what happens here can't influence what happens on the other side of the galaxy. That gets pretty far out there. But if you think about it from that point of view, then the whole cosmos is one big conscious entity. That's a good place to stop. Unless there are more questions.